There's still some people coming in. Don't know if I should wait for them for a few moments. Maybe not. Anyway. Hello, everybody. My name's Ivanka Majic, and I work for the Canonical Design Team. You'll notice that I'm not Matt Acey, and that Matt Acey's not standing next to me. But I assure you, he's with us in spirit. Matt submitted the talk. The title to my talk is Making Linux Sexy, Connecting with Your Users. And the abstract he submitted was for Linux and open source to achieve total world domination, open source needs to follow Apple's lead and focus on interface design as much as infrastructure architecture. This session will address ways that open source communities can keep the end user in mind without sacrificing ideals like freedom. So that was my brief. As I mentioned, I am Ivanka. The blog that my team runs is at design.canonical.com, and I'm available on IRC. My nick is Ivanka, which keeps it simple, I think. My background is very much user research and user experience, and I've been at Canonical for about a year, and the main focus of my work is, of course, Ubuntu. Having said that, it's impossible to talk about Ubuntu without looking at all open source applications and the whole open source ecosystem, because to consider Ubuntu without considering the open source ecosystem would be like making a restaurant and focusing on the decor without thinking about the food. The food in this instance is certainly all the applications, the thousands of applications people run on Ubuntu. So my talk is going to cover three points. I'm going to talk about users, I'm going to talk about language, and I'm going to talk about what it means to be done. And I'll try and keep to my theme. I can talk for ages about lots of things, so if you feel I'm going off track or you have a question, I think putting your hand up might be acceptable, though there is time at the end. I've been told to speak for about 45 minutes so that there's time for questions. And this lovely lady in the front's going to wave at me when it's time to stop talking. So, as a user researcher, it's important for me to understand my audience. I'm very happy to be here, but I've never been to Linux Tag before, and I'm not really familiar with who comes to Linux Tag and what their interests are. So maybe a little bit of audience participation. Who here would call themselves a developer? Who here would call themselves a designer? Who here would call themselves a technologist? I'm missing a whole swathe of the audience. What am I missing? Are we talking business people? Engineers? So a good mixed crowd. Students? Philosophers? Well, it's very nice to meet you, so thank you for coming. When somebody gives me a title, like something like this, I look at it and I think, what do you want me to say? Sexy? What does sexy mean? Sexy is a word that's so easy to apply to design. Oh, make it fabulous, make it sexy. Well, what does that mean to anybody? How can we break that apart? An end user. Who's an end user? An end user is like an amorphous mass of people who may one day stumble across your application and may one day use it. I thought I'd change my title a little bit. So I thought, making Linux irresistible and delighting your target users might be a more focused title. I also thought I'd rewrite the abstract, because I don't really follow the brief if I can avoid it. So for Linux and open source to achieve total world domination, I thought total world domination was a good goal to have, so I kept that in. Open source needs to create great apps. This session will address ways that open source communities can think about and work with their users to create great apps without sacrificing ideals like freedom. The emphasis for the great apps in capital letters, I've stolen, and I've attributed the quote. It was made by Matthew Spellman when he was commenting on a presentation given by Ginger Coons at the recent LGM. I was thinking about how to word these things myself, and I think it's always wise to know when somebody else has got the right words and just to make sure you reference them. I'll talk about Matthew and Ginger Coons a little bit more later. So who are these users? Most of the time when I've seen Linux presentation, there's usually a picture of a geeky guy with maybe an Ubuntu tattoo or you know, long hair. And I thought, well, I like this competition that Ubuntu women ran to look at children who use Ubuntu and who play and use the Ubuntu computer look just like any other. So he's one of the winners. I think it's time that we stop using the term end user. I used the word amorphous mass earlier, and end user is a word that we don't define, we just refer to them all the time. Sometimes they're our mother, sometimes they're our sister, sometimes they're the person that sits next to us, and they don't really get a personality of their own, they don't get their own goals, they don't get their own identity. So I'd like to put out the idea that we must never say end user again. I'd like us to talk instead about designer's intent, about creating things as a willful act of creation, actually thinking about what it is we want people to do, to think about our target audience, about our target users, about how we want to make things that help them achieve their goals. Real people with real goals and real behaviors. I attended a workshop at CHI in Atlanta recently. For those of you who don't know, CHI is an international conference on computer-human interaction. It runs every year. And one of the papers that I saw was by Cohen Chilana. I've got the reference at the end of this presentation. And they'd done quite a lot of research within open source development communities, looking at how developers think about their end users. And they concluded in their research that a lot of those end user behaviors that get talked about are talked about in terms of really more stereotypes, or I watched my mother do this and that's what she does. And working with stereotypes is very dangerous because it creates a distance. First, stereotypes are seldom real. And it creates a distance between what we think people do, what we hope they do, what we'd like them to do, and what they actually do, how they actually behave. So how do we find out about these real goals and behaviors? I think it's important to be honest. Vanity projects are absolutely fine. If you want to play with some technology, if you want to experiment with a new interaction, if you want to play with color, by all means, play, enjoy it. But let's not pretend when we embark on projects like that we're creating them for anyone other than ourselves. I was talking to, within my team, we've got visual designers, user experience people, we've got a user researcher, sort of in-house ethnographer, and I was talking to her before my speech. Her name's Charlene Poirier, she does most of our user research. And Charlene was saying, she goes, Ivanka, you can't, that's very dangerous to talk about people doing projects for themselves. Because I wanted to express it as a, by all means, create on you as the user. Make the very best application you can for you. And that's the danger that she identified was that it was assuming that would be enough. It's one part of creating a whole variety menu of delightful dishes in the applications. It's important, so putting projects like that aside, where we play, we enjoy, and we learn, we also need to observe how people are, what they do, how they behave, and ask them questions. We need to go out, once we've thought about our target audience, so we need to watch them. We need to understand what they do that's different to the way we think they do it, or that stereotypes and our maybe limited experience or our observations of one or two people have led us to believe. Get yourself an expert. an expert in a conversation, in a design conversation, can be very useful. Thankfully, users are experts in their own needs. People do know what they do. They may not always be able to tell you, and sometimes it's a bit of an art to extract the difference between what people say they do and what they actually do. It's sometimes a bit of an art to unpick the difference between the words that are coming out of somebody's mouth and what they're physically doing with an interface. I've run quite a large number of user research projects before, and you can see people in front of a website or an application, and they're frowning, and they're struggling, and they're bent over, and all their body language says that they're irritated. And you ask them, you know, so? Oh, it's lovely. This especially happens if they're English. So being aware of cultural context is also quite important. And context is important. How somebody behaves in a work environment, what they're going to tell you they do when you're talking about a work application, the pressures and the motivations on something that's happening within a production environment are very different to those that happen when we're in play. So, there are luckily both people and things you can learn to help do these. You have to be a little bit careful when you're talking to users, talking to people, talking to groups of people, and you're trying to identify their goals, because it can giving them everything they say they want and say they need can lead to all sorts of hideous monstrosities and expensive failing projects. So it's an art, and it's fun. It's one of my favorite things about what I do is observing people. Because I lead the design team, people often refer to me as a designer. I'm much more comfortable referring to myself as a user researcher. Looking at where people and technology meet, the power that we have as designers in influencing people's lives, in giving them things that they enjoy, that make them more productive, that help them achieve what they want to do, is something that I find fascinating and rewarding. So, just some simple things. There's different ways of asking questions, as I mentioned. Actually, when I was doing my audience participation bit earlier, I didn't ask if there were any user researchers or ethnographers, anthropologists, anybody of that ilk, psychologists. Hooray! So, welcome. So, with the ways that we can ask people questions to try and unpick the way they do things, so particular things that can be helpful or not so helpful. And I just wanted to make this presentation not just about me talking about the things I enjoy talking about, but try and help us come away with something useful. So asking questions that can give you a yes or no answer are very limiting. Asking leading questions like, "You really like my new app, don't you?" Is not particularly helpful and won't lead the conversation. A yes-no answer will close down a conversation, and it's only really as you get people talking that maybe it's the fifth sentence they come to that actually contains the crux of what you're trying to solve. Don't interrupt them. Let them talk. Let them meander through their thoughts. Let them explain what they're doing. Don't tell them they're wrong unless you absolutely have to. It's very difficult, especially when you're trying to find out things for your own project or for your own, on your own application or your own device. It's very, very tempting to go, no. If you click here and here, it's fine. And you can certainly do that if you must, but wait till the end of the session. Wait till you've found out for yourself everything that's not right. What you can do, though, is when you're doing a session like this, is you can put people at ease. "Hi, I just want you to have a quick look at my application. I'm not testing you, I'm testing my ideas." It's quite good not to confess that it's yours as well, because then they're more likely to tell you what they really don't like. And don't explain to them in advance too much how it works. Just see what happens. So starting questions with what, where, why, how, things like that that will require a more thoughtful answer. Answer questions with questions. I find that's quite difficult to do sometimes because it feels rude. So how do I do this? How do you think you do that? It's a conversation that wouldn't necessarily happen in real life. You try and help them. deviate from your script. You might have an idea of what you want to talk to people about, what you want to find out, but things might come up that are worth pursuing. Count what people are doing. Keep a track of where they tried to go, what they tried to do, where it took them, what happened. There's just a few little ways in a simple conversation that you can find out quite a lot about what doesn't work. If it's a device that you're testing, just putting it in somebody's hand and seeing how they pick it up can tell you a lot about, you know, where you've put your buttons, or if the screen's too big, if people start moving it around, if it's too big, too small. There's lots of things you can do. Do that with a few people and you've immediately got a bit of insight into what is and isn't working with your product. For, I don't know how many people here are familiar with the Ubuntu community. Should we go show of hands? Anybody know what UDS is? somebody at the back there. Every 6 months we have an Ubuntu Developer Summit, and this year it's a time where community and Canonical get together. We talk about what's going to happen in the next release. And at this last UDS, we had the subject of a user experience advocacy role came up. The conversation was centered around the fact that most open source projects have a maintainer. They have a developer who is the initiator of the project, the person that got it rolling, the person who got it started. And that person makes the decisions. And often those are very technology-led decisions. You know, what's going to be quickest to implement, what's easiest to implement, what's most interesting to me right now, what are my other dependencies? And so we thought perhaps the proposal was, and this is definitely something that GNOME has tried previously, and GNOME Usability have been talking about it since UDS as well. And it was deemed to be time to discuss having a user experience advocacy person on as many open source projects as possible. So that alongside the maintainer, who's representing more the technology, that you could have somebody who represents the user. Currently, this being open source land and community land, there's a lot of debate about what that role should be and who it should be and how qualified they need to be. And there's a sort of scale of thinking that even having somebody who's interested in user experience, even if they have no previous experience, no knowledge, would actually be more beneficial to a debate than not having it at all. And then the other end of the scale, you've got, no, it has to be an expert. So in the meantime, while the user experience community is sorting this out, or the open source community is sorting this out for themselves, I'm sort of plowing on and talking about it, because I think it's a really good idea. Also, if you're sometimes having designer-to-designer conversations, or user-experience-to-user-experience conversations are just easier. But I'll cover that a bit more when I get to the language bit. So I thought I'd put this lovely slide in, and we could take a moment and say goodbye to our end user. And from now on, let's just think about users. People with real goals, people who want to do stuff. The second part of my conversation is about language. And there's a story that I told at UDS when I was last time. And sometimes, because I've worked for Canonical for just over a year, as I think I've already mentioned, and we have it's a very technology-oriented environment, and it's very new to me. I've never worked anywhere quite like it. And I often find myself having these conversations where I feel like I'm sitting there going, tomato, tomato, tomato. And I get this smiling face back at me going, cabbage. No. So we have, there's communication issues. There's things we're talking about exactly the same thing, but in such differing language that it just doesn't turn into a conversation. It just, both parties walk away slightly confused and not sure if anything actually got resolved. So I think language is a place to pause and have a look. So I'm going to talk to you about empathy. Empathy is an open source chat application that we ship on Ubuntu. And Charlene did some user research on some usability testing on empathy. The focus of doing the testing, well, there were two objectives. The first objective was to give empathy some usability findings, something they could use to make empathy better, to make it more irresistible and delightful. The second objective was for us to test ourselves. Our experience is of producing traditional usability reports. A traditional usability report has a description of the problem, probably a picture, a screen grab, a couple of screen grabs just to illustrate exactly what the issue was, and then a recommendation. It'll have issues that are described at three levels most often. There'll be critical issues, there'll be medium issues, and then there'll be bits and pieces that you can fix if you want to. So it was quite interesting. And then we took this usability report and we took it to the empathy developers. We had them all in the same room, it did help. And then we observed what they did with the findings, how they interpreted them and what happened with them. Because one of the big reasons for my role and my team to exist is to contribute these kind of things. And if we're just going to, we can't, you know, I sort of live by the sword, die by the sword. I have to test my own stuff as well. And I can't just chuck things over, there you go, usability report, make it better. So it's quite interesting to watch how a usability finding got translated into a bug. Everything happens in bugs. Bugs are work items, bugs are the things that developers know they have to fix. Everything gets fitted around bugs. So you went from very user-centric usability report to an application-centric bug. So it'd be user, it's not clear to the users that their account is disabled. The bug gets translated into the account says it's disabled even when it's not. And it just becomes this very application-centric interpretation what was evidently very hard to do was to describe, because you can't describe as a bug an underlying problem. So often the problems people have with an application is that it simply doesn't match their mental models. I have a perfect example. Last night as I arrived in my hotel, I was given a key in the shape of a card. I'm sure you've all seen them. And I arrived very late and it was quite dark in the hallway. There were no lights. And I walked up to the door. And I was trying to, there was no slot. So I was like, oh, it's not on the front. It's not on the top. I got my mobile phone out. It's not on the side. It's not underneath. It was an RFID card key. But I've never encountered one of those before. So it was only because, I don't know what possessed me to try, because I was about to go downstairs and go, I don't know how to open this door. So, you know, we all come to everything with our mental models. And, for example, with empathy, the users in the testing expected everything to be centered around the contacts. Because the reason they're in a chat is because they want to talk to people. Whereas the whole chat application is designed around accounts. So you have, you set up different accounts and it's just, there's this total disconnect between the way users are coming to it and the way the developers are coming to it. So it's much more difficult to describe that in a bug and make it fixable. So that's one thing we do. We also have come across a project that Alex Farborg at Mozilla has initiated. I also came across this at CHI. We covered it at UDS, and I think it's an important thing. The idea being that the initiative is around using heuristics to tag bugs. I don't know how many of you read conversations and mailing lists in the open source environment around design, but Fitt's Law gets mentioned a lot. It's something that everybody knows, everybody's heard of, and there are many, many, many aspects to design and user experience, and Fitt's Law is one of them. So I think one of the things where this will be very useful is the idea is that we tag bugs with heuristics. Feedback is an example of a usability heuristic. So if the user's not got feedback, they don't know what to do, they don't know if something happened, did it not happen, have I failed, have I succeeded? So the idea behind this project is that when you file a bug, you tag it with a heuristic and you start creating a group of problems that are associated with the same usability principle. I think it certainly starts addressing this kind of problem and also that problem of language, usability experts talking about feedback, and people, there not being enough examples, or it's not clear enough. Another initiative that we have is paper cuts. Paper cuts has been remarkably successful for such a simple initiative and a simple idea. I did usability testing. It was the first thing I did when I got to Canonical. I did some usability testing on Ubuntu. And I just found lots of little tiny things that just didn't work. Or they weren't finished. Or the error message would say things like, cannot mount drive, okay? No, that's not okay at all, actually, because I want to read my hard drive. So it's those lots of little things that just need to be sorted out. So the Paper Cuts project is something that we lead, but the community, well, the community do it all, frankly, but they let us join in. And we've done a remarkable job in two cycles. In the first cycle, sort of 70-odd bugs fixed. Second one, 100 was hit quite easily. But, you know, this has been a massive contributor to the Lucid release, for example, just feeling tighter, because a lot of these things have been sorted out. The language thing, I wasn't sure as I was writing my slides whether actually it should have been perspective and not language that I should have been talking about, because the thing that's really different when it comes, I don't know that this is why I can't decide on whether it's language or perspective. It's this, the difference between looking at putting the technology or the application at the center of what you're doing, or putting the user at the center of what you're doing. And sometimes it's so similar, it's hard to pull apart, but those subtle differences and the subtle differences in language and emphasis make a massive difference to the user. I got sent this article by a former colleague of mine who is a usability person, user research expert. I used to work with him, and he sent me this email, and he rather sarcastically put, he said, oh, I'm so relieved to find out after all this time that it was, after all, the user's fault. And, which I thought, I was like, thanks for that. But then I had a look at it, and the very first thing that it says is, it says, oh, the first mistake people make when they use Linux is that they assume that they're using Windows. Well, let's take a little sidestep and visit Alice in Wonderland for a moment. This quote comes from the part just after Alice has been very big and she's been crying, and then she takes the potion or eats the rest of the pill and she's suddenly very, very small. Her first idea was that she had somehow fallen into the sea. And in that case, I can go back to railway, she said to herself. Alice had been to the seaside once in her life and had come to the general conclusion that wherever you go on the English coast, you find a number of bathing machines in the sea, some children digging in the sand with wooden spades, then a row of lodging houses, and behind them, a railway station. In the same way that I spent quite a number of minutes last night looking for a slot on the door, because every hotel room I've ever been to that's given me a card has expected me to put it into a slot. We come to things with mental models. We come to things with ideas of how they work. We use our experiences and things we know to solve problems. So to say it's the user's fault for knowing how Windows works is perhaps not the best way of looking at it. Perhaps there's a cleverer way that we can take what they know and what they've learned and use that to lead them into Linux and lead them into these different distros and help them to discover what's great about them. As humans, we make predictions based on previous experience. We use habits to help us reduce mental effort. How often have you driven a car, got to your destination and gone, I can't remember half that journey? It happens to all of us. There are many things that we do that have become so part of our habits. They're so mechanical that we don't think. What shortcut keys do you use? You know, my mother, it's bad to use my mother, but there you go. She's such a wonderful source of quotes. But whenever she tries to remember one of her friend's number, I was going, what's Huguette's number again? She'll actually stop and mimic her. She'll go, 564, 508. Oh, there you go. So it's just become these little patterns get embedded in our minds and we repeat them. And we think by trying. And just like Alice was trying to think about how to get out of the pool, thinking that, you know, if I was at the beach, if this was the sea, there'd be a railway station. We all do that. So what is a bug? I don't want to say out loud the tomato and tomato, but it is a bit of that. It's like, you know, I have ongoing conversations about what a critical bug is. For in the empathy research, a critical usability bug was that people couldn't set up their accounts. I think that's a critical usability bug. If you can't set up your accounts, you can't use the application. But the code compiled and it worked. So, and I have this, you know, just before release, I'm on IRC going, because FSpot, which ships on Ubuntu, at one point it was loading with without a big enough screen to see your photograph or the buttons. So I was like, this is a critical bug, it can't ship like this. No, it's not. Well, yes, it is, because the first time somebody boots up, you know, boot up their Linux machine, they double-click on their photograph, up comes this application, only showing half their picture and no buttons. So, well, it's broken, isn't it? It doesn't work. Because they don't have to resize the window to find out what they're doing. So, critical is an interesting word. And we have to remember that beautiful, fast, well-executed code can still create a showstopper. The code can be amazing and it can still be unusable. Equally, beautiful and well-designed interfaces can just be useless if the underlying code doesn't work, doesn't run very well. You know, there's a total dependency here where we're totally dependent on each other to create those user experiences to make Linux irresistible and delightful. So how do we define done? When can we stop for a nice cup of coffee and go, good work? Well, that's not so easy to decide, I don't think. So if we go back to those paper cuts, the paper cuts project, many of those paper cuts are really small. They've been around for a long time, for years, some of them. And they just linger. Because, and I don't know, because I don't necessarily think I've done enough research into this particular area, but I think it just gets a bit boring. So you're the developer, you've done all the interesting bits, you've got the clever new technology working, and now you need to phrase an error message. It's like, they can work it out, you know, it'll be fine. And I don't know if it's a lack of, it's just not, and I can understand why that would be, all those soaking up all those little bugs is less interesting. But then we have found that a lot of younger developers who want to start contributing to a project, for them it's really easy to pick up a paper cut. We define a paper cut as something that can be fixed in one day, so it should be something that's very straightforward to do. So I don't know if that helps. And then when I was thinking about how I was going to talk about this part of what I think are with making Linux irresistible and delightful, I came across this presentation that I already mentioned by Ginger Coons. And she talked to LGM last week, I think it was, about why designers, visual designers, graphic designers, don't use Linux more. What is it that stops them? She described some problems like, you know, people have wedded to Photoshop, they're wedded to the Adobe Suite, they're used to using Illustrator. She talked about problems with peer recognition. If you're using the wrong thing, you're not as clever as me. If you're not doing that, there's lots of associations that way. But it's very hard to break a 20-year habit for some people. But she did talk about some real reasons why it'd be really good to have these people in the community. You know, professionals mean professional problems. They mean more interesting challenges. It means something that can help raise the bar, because it's one thing, you know, talking about people behaving differently in context, you know, I can be much more tolerant of something that I'm doing for fun than I am if I'm doing it because I need to get paid. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is very clear here, you know, food and shelter, quite low on the pyramid. So having those professionals may raise the bar. And she also suggests that by necessity, they're a dedicated group. They will get stuck in. They will, I've got 10 minutes left. They would get involved, and they'd be actually a useful part of the community. Now, I have found, going back to mentioning that user advocacy role for a moment, I have found, especially when I first started a year ago, I blog a bit, because my previous communities, my peer community as a user experience, user research person, those people, oh, we'd like to help, what can we do? And I go, well, I'll go to Launchpad, look at some bugs. Then I get these emails going, I can't hang out in there. I don't know what's going on, I don't understand what people are talking about, what's GTK? You know, it's all a bit complicated. So having having well-defined roles and bringing people in because you want to include them on the project can be very useful. I know that the Blender work very well with designers and developers alongside each other working on features. And that seems to me like a great way to get really exciting, well put together stuff in an open source project. She goes on to suggest that if we get them while they're young, teach them while they're at university, ease compatibility, and this applies to many open source projects. Unfortunately, I put my little sister off open source for life, I think, for my sins, about 10 years ago when she was still at university and I installed OpenOffice and forgot to explain file formats to her, and she submitted a file to her one of her lecturers in the wrong format, and she nearly lost a grade. You know, she might not have been getting paid, but that grade meant a lot to her. All was resolved happily, nobody failed anything, but it really put her off. We have to think about the compatibility, the need to share, the need to pass things around. Ginger suggests dumbing it down, the installation process can be very complicated. I'd argue that that might be smartening it up. Let them know it exists and improve distribution channels. I want to add one other thing to that. I believe that, and in my experience I have noticed, that one killer feature that's really well executed can get people to go and experiment with something that they otherwise wouldn't. And they'll go through a pain barrier for something that's more interesting and more exciting and more delightful. If you use the experience of the BlackBerry versus iPhone for a moment, the BlackBerry is a very well engineered device and it's been successful. And you could tap away very quickly. And in usability studies, it beats the iPhone. The iPhone, though, delights. And delight is something that is hard to measure, but it's massively important if you want to bring people over to a new interaction paradigm, if you want them to relearn their habits and break them. So how do we make sure engineers and designers are on the same page? She says, reading from her slide. I try and avoid doing that, but I got sucked in for a moment. We need to understand each other's work so that we can bridge the gap between us. So things like the Empathy Project, I hope to do more of that. I hope to get designers and engineers working more closely together and create mediator roles like the UX user experience advocate. I think that's a great idea, and I hope it will gain some traction. And keep thinking. There's lots of things we can constantly reinvent the ways we work together. Design is an iterative process which applies to both product and process alike. How do we make sure designers, engineers and users are on the same page? Well, we need to create multiple points of connection. There are lots of different ways you can do research. There's lots of different ways. You can contact us. We'll do some research for you. We can teach you how to do research. Other people can. You can teach us how to make stuff. Maybe that's what I'll start doing. I'll do the research, then I'll learn. Okay, go back to coding. But there are things you can do to create those points of connection. Share research techniques and just work together. I think that will make a massive difference. We can redefine what done means. Questions? Yes, sorry. I think simply referring to them as users, but knowing who they are would be helpful. End user often gets used as a... Alex Farborg would disagree with me. I read his blog. He says, let's stop talking about users. It's a question, I think, of talking about users rather than a hand-wavy end user. End user feels to me like an accidental user. Yes. That's how I feel about it. Okay, there's a question over there.
If you say that one killer feature gets users to switch, what do you see as, or in the future, as Ubuntu's one killer feature?
Let me get my crystal ball for a moment. That's a wonderful question. Let me think. I think that I don't know the answer first, but I think there are lots of things being done, and by being more open to user input in the process, we'll find that killer feature. I think for me, right now, because I have an Ubuntu machine and I have a Mac, and I commute by train every day to work, and I'm an hour on the train because I live on the South Coast and I work in London. And if I'm using my Mac, if I've got my 3G dongle in, every time the signal drops out, I have to disconnect and reconnect. Ubuntu stays connected the whole journey. Signal gets very low, it drops out for a second, and then it sorts itself out. I don't have to get involved. For me, right now, that's a killer feature. Sorry? Thank you to Red Hat for that. Yes?
Ubuntu has a feature to collect what programs I am using. What programs I am using, and do you evaluate all the results collected from this program for putting emphasis on new developments or better usage of some programs?
I am not a great user of quantitative data. It's not the first place I look. I know that the knowing, so it's called POP something, I can't remember what it's called, but it's by, you have to agree to let your data be collected. So it's a limited set of people that you're collecting data from, and the features, and I'm not sure how much value there is in that in its current format. So equally, I've not really got to it and I've not picked it apart yet. But we need to have a purpose before we go and query the data. And I think we need to be conscious of who says yes to let their data be collected. I hope that answers the question.
I often do usability reports in bug tracking systems, and in my experience it's often very difficult to describe what you are thinking or how you want to have this feature or to transportate usability ideas. Yeah. Are there any attempts to support this by tools? For example, easy to do screenshots and putting annotations to it on something like this.
There's conversations at the moment. There's nothing tangible happening yet. But if you stay in touch with me, perhaps we could work on something together. Because I've had conversations with Marin Duffy. I've had conversations, GNOME Hackfest. I've had conversations with various people, but never because collaborating on images is actually quite hard. And most of the bug tracking tools that I've come across don't deal with screenshots very well. Something as simple as that, just getting even a hand-drawn sketch in. There's kind of a barrier to doing it just because it's so much effort. So I don't know yet, but let's do something.
Already got the mic. First of all, sorry, I have to hijack this just a little bit. We are doing a small get-together of usability and open source tomorrow morning from 9 till 12 in New York 2, I think it is, which is organized from openusability.org and from OpenOffice User Experience Team. Just wanting to get you to know this. So you're welcome. Just join us tomorrow morning. And I actually have a question. We're always talking about the community we have in open source, and this is something I missed in your presentation. I mean, shouldn't we find ways to actually activate the community? I always feel like developers are sort of, they feel that the end user is sort of sort of giving them feedback they don't want, but when they need feedback, they don't know how to get it. So there is a community,
I think that's what the user advocacy role can do if we use it properly. It can be, you know, there are projects out there that genuinely properly have a user experience person within their team, somebody they talk to. There's Torsten Vilmus, he works on Arda, he does things with them. They have go-to people. I don't think what we've pulled off yet is putting people in touch with each other properly. When I was talking about bridging the gap and working together, and that user advocacy role I see as a way of taking open usability interested experts and plugging them into projects so that they can bring people feedback in a way that gives you less Homer's car and more killer features. So I think that's one of the ways I see that happening.
So if you say you get the usability advocate for each project or each program, how do you make sure that you have like a coherent user experience that is not contradictory and all the programs seem like they're working together and everything?
What do you mean?
I mean, you have to make sure that all the different projects also talk to each other to have the same concept of user interface design. So,
the starting point, the place this conversation started, was from the Paper Cuts project and us realizing that we'd like things changed from a user experience point of view, but we didn't know, there was nobody in the upstream project that openly that you need to, hard to find the person who's interested in it in the upstream project. And so the initial conversation was, why don't we create a directory of usability people and their associations on open source projects, so you can go, it's Arda, I need to find Torsten and talk to him, and so that there's, and then you know, they know their maintainer, they have a relationship with the maintainer, and then they can take some information, then these people could talk to each other. I mean, that's where it started, which is, so I think that the community of user experience people should exist alongside the community of developers, and then everybody magically fits together and it all happens beautifully with some hand wavy design. Is that it? My run. I had a 5 minutes thing waved at me. Does that mean I'm done? No? Okay. Any more questions? I'm getting quite warm. No, good. Well, thank you very much for coming.